Welcome to the Execution Zone podcast, where we tackle the challenge of why executing strategy is so much harder than actually creating it. We talk openly and honestly with entrepreneurs and leaders who will share the behind-the-scenes story of their own journey. This will give you the insights that you need to shortcut your own path to success. Welcome to the Execution Zone podcast. I'm Abby White. This week, we have got the most phenomenal Lorraine Murphy and just so many nuggets of gold and gems in this conversation for you. Lorraine, if you haven't come across her before and have been hiding under a rock, is an award-winning entrepreneur, speaker, mother, mentor, and absolute superwoman. Lorraine talks through her journey of starting the Remarkables Group in 2012 and achieving $1 million in her first year and such a high growth journey. Lorraine then talks to also exiting that business and her decisions and reasons for that, and the lessons she's then learned going on and starting her second business. Lorraine is, in my opinion, the absolute master of all things get shit done and overcoming barriers to execution. And in this conversation, we really tap into what it is there that makes Lorraine different and tips and tricks that you can also take on board. Lorraine has gone on to write 3 books, and we pull out various nuggets of gold out of each of the 3 books. Lorraine also talks to finding her soul on fire work, as she calls it. And I think that's a really great conversation for many of us. And I'm sure a lot of us can relate to that. We then go into talking about how Lorraine deals with setbacks, how you kickstart a new habit, her non-negotiables, her book recommendations, and so much more. Lorraine, to me, just is absolutely all about execution and getting stuff done. So I genuinely believe there is no better person to have this conversation with. I will give you a heads up warning. Both of us like to swear. So if you have got a little one, there's definitely some swearing in this episode, but you will absolutely love it. Make sure you have got your pad and a pen ready to take down some epic notes from the phenomenal Lorraine Murphy. Welcome to this week's episode with the amazing Lorraine Murphy, who I am beyond excited to catch up with. Lorraine and I were just chatting and saying, this is the way that I'm now catching up with people.
And me too. It's a sad state of affairs.
Is using a podcast. So guys, if you need to get in touch with your friends, this is the way to do it.
Start a podcast. Yes.
So I want to share for anyone who has been under a rock and not come across Lorraine a little bit about Lorraine's story and background to kickstart us. So Lorraine started her first business, the Remarkables Group, which was a talent agency for social influencers in 2012, and then went on to win Emerging Agency of the Year and hit $1 million in revenue within 12 months by 2013. By 2015, Lorraine was already listed on BRW Fast Starter list. And by 2016, went on to win Entrepreneur of the Year and write her first book, Remarkability, which actually I reread parts of it last night in preparation for this. And it's so interesting reading it a couple years on and taking completely different things out of it. It was really interesting.
I was actually reading it myself randomly. I had it with me to go to a speaking gig. I had a few copies of Remarkability. And I was reading it, and it's such an amazing thing to like tune back into that stage of my life, if that makes sense. It was really cool. Anyway, sorry, I'm interrupting your intro.
No, this is really, I really like this timeline. So Lorraine has a timeline on her website of her career. And I was like, this is awesome. This is a great way to introduce someone and go through
Thank you.
So in 2017, Lorraine went on to have her beautiful little girl, Lexi, who is super, super, super cute, and then made the decision to exit that first business, the Remarkables Group. Lorraine went on to start her second business in 2018, which she focused on, to use Lorraine's word, her soul on fire work. And I'm going to be asking Lorraine what she defines as soul on fire and what that is to her. And then wrote her second book, Get Remarkably Organized. By 2019, Lorraine had her third book, which is Baby, You're Remarkable. And I personally met Lorraine several years ago, and I'll tell my embarrassing story. So the first time I met Lorraine, I'm kind of mortified telling this story. I'd been reading Lorraine's books, following her work, following her on Instagram, and was just so in love with the work that she was doing, total and utter fangirl, and saw Lorraine speak and like plucked up the courage after ages to go and say hi and ask for a photo. And I'm so glad.
Was that when I was really pregnant? That's when I was like 38 pregnant, wasn't it? The blue dress at the entourage.
Yes, you were literally.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
And oh, this is so mortifying. And I literally was just so excited to meet Lorraine that I couldn't even get my words out. I was like, And then it's actually been really interesting preparing for this interview because there's been so many like snippets and nuggets that I've either read from your book or read from following you or working with you that have then gone on to shape things that I've done. So excited to share some of those pearls of wisdom and nuggets in this podcast with everyone else.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I remember you coming up with it. You were not half as embarrassing as you think you are. You were absolutely gorgeous. But I think you told me that it was my responsibility that you went and got pregnant very quickly after that, because you said that you saw me on stage as someone who had their own business and was pregnant. And you said, yeah, I can do this, which was the whole idea of my third book. So yeah, I'm so delighted to be on the podcast.
Yeah, you have a lot to answer for that. I saw you.
I do.
I went to an event, and I think it was an Entourage event, and my husband was there as well. And you were talking about, yeah, Lexi, business baby. And I'm like, see, you know, people do it. She does it. You know, we can do this. And we're like, right, okay. And we had the confidence to start trying for what turned out to be Jaden. So yeah, you have a lot to answer for in my life.
Well, he looks pretty special, so yeah, I did well.
I'll text you that on the nights where I get no sleep and I've got massive bags under my eyes.
Yes, been there, don't worry.
So look, what I do want to do is do a whistle stop tour on background, just to get everyone on the same page. So what I would love to understand is that we talked about you starting Remarkables Group and it being the first talent agency for social influencers. What I'd love to know is how you went upon executing that idea. Because when I've heard you tell the story, you talk about being in your bathroom, thinking it's a great idea, which is one thing, but executing on it is another. Can you fill in the gaps for us?
Yeah, such a great question. Well, I think the first block that I had, so I decided I wanted to start this business. And I actually spoke to my direct boss about it. And she said, well, look, she'd just been given a lot of responsibility to change up I was in public relations and comm strategy. She'd just been giving a lot of responsibility to change the whole team. And she said, look, I need to know if you're in or you're out. You know, if you're out, then that's fine, but I need to know. So I kind of felt like I got a bit of a kick up the ass from her. So I went home. I remember sitting on the bus home that day, and I made a list of all the obstacles that I would need to overcome in order to start this business. And then I went home that night and I actually started a plan. I kicked off a plan. So the biggest block I actually had to start in the business was my visa, because I was sponsored by my job. So if anyone was a fellow 457 buddy, I was on a 457 visa, which meant that if I started my business, I couldn't actually be employed by that business. So first of all, I needed my visa. And the other challenge, happily, money, I had some cash saved up because I basically lived in a tenement for 3 years. So I'd saved up some money, which was great. And then the big thing was, you know, what was the business going to be called? What was the website going to be? All those classic startup challenges. So the first thing I tackled was the visa, because I'd been told that it would take me 9 to 12 months to get approved for the visa. And so I was going to go de facto on my boyfriend at the time. He's an Aussie citizen. So I was going to go de facto on him, with him, whatever you say. And I sent away the visa application and figured it was going to take, you know, 9 to 12 months. So I kind of sat back on my heels for a bit and was like, cool, well, once the visa gets approved, then I'll start to really figure out what's happening. And the visa, I still to this day do not know what the hell happened with that visa application, but it came back within 4 weeks, 4 weeks to the day I had approval on the visa. And then I said, oh shit, I wasn't expecting this to happen till October. It's now, I think it was February. It was on a leap year, actually. It was the 29th of February. I remember getting the letter back from the Department of Immigration. And I said, whoa, okay, this is on, like this needs to happen. And a big fear that I had, and it actually happened a few times while I was working on the idea, the influencers that I was going to start representing, they got asked by a few people, hey, I'm thinking about doing this business. And they just didn't say anything. But I was terrified of being pipped to the post. And I think it was a really good thing. It gave me a really strong sense of urgency. And even now, if I'm launching something new, like I'm in such a hurry to get it out into the world because I want to be first with it. I don't want anyone to beat me to the finish line. So then it was on. So pretty much I was working Monday to Friday in my job, and I would spend the weekends and the evenings working on my business. So the big things I need to focus on was getting the bloggers signed up. So I had three at the time. We call them bloggers. Now obviously we call them social influencers. So at the time I had relationships with three influencers that had said, if you do this, I'll sign with you. And then I needed to find two more. So I found them. So I pretty much, on the day I started my business, I had five influencers signed up. My website was ready to go. I had my VoIP landlines, the stuff that, you know, was really important in 2012 that I needed to have like a landline so it looked like I was a proper business. Whereas now I look at like really established businesses and they just use their mobile. So it's just funny how different it is now. Mm. And I was ready to go. So as I said, the biggest thing I needed to overcome was the visa situation, because that was something I just, unless I got that result, I couldn't do anything. And then it was just, yeah, nose down. What do you say? Head down, bum up. Just get everything ready. I had this really strong idea because I had money saved up to support myself for 6 months. But I had this idea that I wanted a turnkey business. And I'd done this like webinar over lunch when I still had my job. And I was thinking about starting the business. And the guy who'd presented it said, you want to have a turnkey business. And it just really resonated with me. And what he meant by that is if you're starting a new business, that you pretty much have everything ready to go so you can start making money on day one of that business. You're not, excuse my French, fucking around with the website for 3 months or trying to get your logo right. Like, you want to have everything ready to go so that you can start making money from the very first day you open your doors. And that's something I do a lot of mentoring with entrepreneurs. And that's something that I spend a lot of time with them on. You don't want to be eating into valuable money-making time when you start your business. You want to have as much as humanly possible done by the time you start your business. So when I opened those doors on that Wednesday morning, it was the 16th of May, everything was ready to go. Like, I got my first business call 2 hours later. So does that answer your question? I feel like I could go down a million rabbit holes with that story.
It's actually really good, because I'll save it for a minute, but in a minute what I'm so excited to talk to you about is, it's really funny. I was talking to Lisa Burling this morning, who was on last week, and we were talking about...
How did you meet Lisa? What word did that come about?
Oh my gosh, I've known Lisa for years. I met her randomly when I approached her about doing a speaking thing when I was involved in She Business. So this is like, I don't know, 5 years ago, something like that. And then we've just kept in touch ever since. But obviously you are working with Lisa as well, so it's all very incestuous. But we were talking this morning about the fact I was doing the podcast with you, and I was like, I actually don't know anyone better to talk to about execution and about getting shit done. You kind of owned that space of getting shit done. So in a minute, I do actually want to tap into some of what you've just talked about there in terms of how you got everything lined up, ready to go. You didn't wait for it to be perfect. But before I do, I actually just want to step back on one thing, which is you just talked there about being first to market. And actually your approach and answer I really like, because it's quite different. Rather than looking at it as scary of being first to market, you're owning it and you're wanting it.
Because that's the thing. If you're first to market, no one can ever take that away from you. You're always going to be the first. And I traded on that so hard. Like, happily the business went on to be an awesome success, but I traded that to, you know, the nth degree that we were the first, we were the first, we were the first. For me, it was very important positioning to have. I didn't want to be the second. You know, it doesn't have quite the same ring to it.
But talk to us about the educating the market piece, because what you've got in common with, again, another one of your buddies, this is so incestuous, Julie, who talked about this in terms of being first to market, is you actually, if you're coming out with something new and different, so in 2012, you know, what the hell is a social influencer? How did you educate the market being first?
Well, I kind of had a triple whammy. So first of all, I had no business experience at all. And second of all, I was, well, kind of a double whammy. Second of all, then I was actually, well, I had convinced myself so much at how powerful social influencers were, and I got the value of it. And my clients that I tested it with got the value. But the big challenge that I had is that a lot of the biggest brands in Australia didn't get the value. They just didn't understand what the potential was with this space. And then the triple whammy is that even if they did understand it, they definitely didn't believe in paying those influencers for their content. So there was a lot at play. And I actually read a brilliant book, which I'd highly recommend. I get so many of my mentees onto it, called The Ultimate Sales Machine. And it's by a guy called Chet Holmes, who's passed away about 4 years ago now. And it was my manual to sales, because I had no sales experience whatsoever. And what he talked about is that your biggest responsibility when you're selling is to educate your audience. Mm. And I realized that I went to meetings for maybe 6 weeks, and I was getting nowhere. Like, hey, this is my business, you know, my crappy first logo and my terrible presentation. And I wasn't getting anywhere. And I just realized, oh, they're not ready for it. Like, I'm selling them something that they don't even know they need. So at that point, that was one of the biggest, probably the best insight I ever had in that business. Because at that point, then I went right back to basics. And said, okay, they don't actually know they need this. So how do I educate them that they do need it? So I put together a 90-minute presentation I think it was probably something terrible, like Influencer Marketing 101 or Blogger, whatever it was called. And instead of me then reaching out to the Qantases, the Nestles, the Woolworths of the world saying, hey, can I come and sell you my new business? I was saying, hi, I've put together this 90-minute training presentation. I've already delivered for XYZ brand. Is this something that you would be interested in having your team attend? So I really positioned it as a training and not as a sales pitch. And oh my God, Abby, I remember the first time that someone had said yes, I think it was actually Nestle. And I drove over to Homebush, which is where Nestle's head office is. And I walked into the room expecting like, you know, one or two juniors, which is but pretty much who I was getting when I was trying to do the sales meeting. And I walked in and there was 25 people in that room and they hung on every freaking word I said. And that was my like, oh my God, I've been doing this all wrong. So pretty much I just educated and educated and educated. If they had any questions, I was happy to answer them over email or phone. And so it was more than a foot in the door. I think for me, it was for the vast, if not all of them, I was the person who was kind of the messiah of this new influencer marketing space. And which meant that, you know, maybe they weren't in a position to buy or they weren't in a position to start investing with me straight away. But it did mean that as they kind of got their head around the space and they were like, yeah, okay, cool. We want to do some, you know, some testing, that I was the first person that came to mind because I'd established myself so much as the thought leader in that space. So that's pretty much what I did. And then it built momentum from there. I mean, there's obviously lots of other things like putting myself forward for awards and, getting testimonials and bringing a lot more rigor to the influencer marketing space, like setting set rates and tiers of rate cards and all that kind of thing. But the educating the market, if I hadn't have done that in those first 6 months, that business wouldn't have succeeded. Yeah, and I do think it's a mistake a lot of people make when it comes to sales is they just think if they talk at people enough that they'll eventually buy and they miss the opportunity to actually educate their audience.
I love that. I think sales so much is about education today. It literally is what it's about. And I couldn't agree more. I was looking at my diary earlier and I think over the next 2 weeks, I've got four different lunch and learns, exactly what you were just talking about of going in and educating. But I also find it's a really great way to test the messaging and test what resonates. You know, you see when people go, oh.
So true. Or, yes, you're right.
So it's also a great testing ground. So on that note, I actually want to dig into that because you went on to have phenomenal success. And like we talked about in the intro, you know, over $1 million in 12 months, which is just, you know, off the charts. What do you think some of your keys to sales and marketing were, sort of beyond the fact you adopted such a healthy mindset to sales about education? You talked about some awards there. You know, what were the other contributing factors that you think led to such quick success?
Well, I do think coming back to an earlier point, I think being first to market helped massively because we owned it. And when I decided to sell the Remarkables Group a couple of years ago, there was a write up in one of the trade magazines, B&T, and so it was online. It's an online title, and they described me as the pioneer of the influencer marketing space in Australia. So when you think about how much that industry is worth now, it's like holy shit! Like that's an incredible incredible compliment. So yeah. I think being first to market helped massively, but obviously we're not all in a position to be first to market. I think the second thing was definitely the education. The other thing that I really, and I've done this since my PR days, is focusing on quality over quantity. I'm never someone that's going to work the whole room. When I go to an event, I'm very introverted and I hate networking. Like the idea of networking just makes me sick. So I'm never going to be the person that goes around and shoves a business card into everyone's hand. I've always, since I moved to London, which was like in the third year of my career, I've always believed in focusing on quality relationships rather than quantity, you know, having lots and lots of surface level relationships. So that's something I think I did well, was to pick the people first of all, that I really enjoyed spending time with. But second of all, the people that were the decision makers and would be in a position to actually spend money with my business. So I think that was a really big one. I also think just being personable, I learned that very early on as well, that I don't need to switch into Lorraine sales mode. Like I can just be me. And I think it's one of my superpowers. I talk a lot about the idea of superpowers and that we should all know what our superpowers are in our individual roles or our businesses. But one of my superpowers is building relationships quickly, but also maintaining them over a long-term time period.
You're actually very thoughtful at that. I will say, as someone who, you know, when I was pregnant with Jaden, you would text me and see how I was doing. When I've gone through really, really crappy phases, you know, a card will turn up in the post that you've sent, you know, thinking of you. You're very thoughtful and very good at keeping in touch. And I know you do that in a business context too, with, you know, thank you cards and stuff like that.
Yeah. But I think this is the thing, isn't it? And it's about making people feel special. And Maya Angelou, I mean, this quote's done to death, but I think it's so powerful. That whole idea of people will forget what you said, they'll forget what you did, but they will never forget how you make them feel. So I think for me, treating people like clients and potential clients like real people and making them feel special, we all want that, you know, and that goes a really, really long way, particularly if someone's working in a big organization and they might feel like they're just a cog in the wheel. I think that works really, really well. And also not bullshitting clients. It would have been very easy, particularly with the influencer marketing space back then, because it was so nascent, I could have told people whatever and they would have believed me. But I think not bullshitting clients. And I guess in a nutshell, if I was to summarize everything I've just said, it's to play the long-term game, the long-term relationship game, rather than the quick shag. I know that sounds really brutal, but you know what I mean? That's really horrible. I can't believe I just said that. But that's what it is. You know, you're not looking at people with, oh, they might have a 10 grand. You know, you want to see them as potentially, if I build a really great relationship with this person, they might spend 150 grand over the next 5 years. You know, it's not focusing on the quick buck. It's the long-term relationship. And also remembering that people move from their roles. And yeah, it's not being in their face because they're at a particular company that you want to work with. It's being conscious that you don't know where they're going to go and you don't know who they're going to refer you to. Does that make sense?
It absolutely does. I love that.
It's yeah, so I'm funny. So sorry I said that. Second I said it, I was like, oh, Lorraine, that's like something my husband would say, who's ex-army. That's a very,
this is why,
very him thing to say.
This is why
I spent too much time with him this morning.
No, this is why I love you. This is why do you know what? I've been so excited about this podcast because I just knew it was going to be brilliant. And this is exactly why. Oh,
thank you. Well, please don't put that as a little quotable on Instagram. Thank you.
Lorraine says,
my mother will never forgive me.
Don't go in for the quick shag.
Don't go for quick shag. Oh, God.
So moving on from quick shags.
Yes.
I'm going to have to put like a parental warning or something. I've totally lost my words now. I'm going to move on from the remarkables because I really want to get into the good stuff with you around getting shit done and execution. But I've got to sort of then do the transition from remarkables to what you do now. Yes. So when I got your bio, it was really interesting because obviously I know you, I know what you do. I've been part of your membership. Like I get it. But when I read it, I loved the explanation you used, which was you made the transition to do your soul on fire work. And I love that phrase because I think a lot of people are looking for that. So can you talk us a little bit about leaving remarkables and finding your soul on fire work?
You know, it's funny that you've picked up on that phrase because it was in the media release when I resigned from the remarkables, as in I sold the business and resigned. And it's amazing how many people have asked since then. And because of that, I kind of keep that phrase around. Okay, so for me, I was building the remarkables group. I brought on a business partner while I was pregnant with Lexi. And our plan was to go global with the business. So myself and Wade had pretty solid plans to move to the UK the following year and start the Remarkables Group over there. He was going to start his business over there as well. So he's also an entrepreneur. And then my business partner was going to move to Asia. One of us was going to do the States, probably me. So that was the whole plan. And so the plan was that we'd really go hard at building the business over 5 years. Then we would probably take, you know, if we were lucky, it'd be pretty good if you sold your business over a year, took a year to sell it. We would sell it. And then I'd probably look at doing like a 2-year earnout with whoever bought us. And then I would go and write, speak and mentor full time. That's like my happy place or my soul on firework. And when Lexi was born, I remember I went back into the business properly when she was 3.5 months old. And I was going to events and my heart wasn't in it. Like my soul wasn't in it like it used to be. And I was pretty much looking down the barrel. And like I say that language and that's how it felt, looking down the barrel of 8 years to get to doing stuff that I really, really love to do. And I realized, shit, she's going to be at school. Like she'll be, halfway through primary school at that point. And I think, and I don't know if you'll identify this as well, Abby, or the parents listening do, Will, that when you have a child, like it puts a date on things. Like it really dates things in terms of like Lexi's going to be 3 in June. And it honestly feels like yesterday she was put on my chest after giving birth to her, you know, it's crazy. And I just said, I just don't really want to do that. Like, I don't want to move everything to the UK and start from, you know, I'm happy to work freaking hard. I can work very, very hard. But just the idea of starting from scratch in a market that I'd worked in a number of years before, but not in this sense, I just didn't want to do it. I just didn't light me up like it used to. And I think when Lexi was born, and I know a lot of people, particularly women, say that it changes your priorities. And I don't think it changed my priorities, but it definitely changed what my version of success was. Because back then, my version of success was very externally or ego-driven. It was the awards, the money, the global business, selling it for, you know, X amount of million that I want to sell it for. And after that, after Lexi was born, I think there was a softening. And my priorities, my idea now of what success looks like feels different to what it was before that. So that was the decision. I remember going to a particular event in the city, and I had to, for some reason, I didn't have milk for Lexi. So I was pumping milk in the disabled toilets. I had to throw it in the window of the car because our nanny couldn't stop properly. And all I could see was Lexi's little toes sticking out the back of the capsule. And I just didn't want to be there anymore. I just didn't want to be at that event. I didn't want to be doing what I was doing. I wanted to be doing the Soul on Fire work. And that's, I think, the decision. I didn't realize, I think the decision was made that day on a subconscious level. And then it kind of took about 3-4 weeks for it to actually materialize into the real world. So for me, the Soul on Fire work, like I'm on this interview with you, and I would do this. I mean, you're not paying me obviously to do this interview, but this is technically, it's part of my work. I would do this for free. I would go and speak on Hamilton Island for a corporate, like I did at the weekend, for free, you know. And that's awesome. That's this, and it's the work that I know I'm engaged. And like, that's not to say that I feel like, yeah, every single day of the week with my business. Like, there's definitely days where I'm like, oh my God, like, I just don't feel like doing, not the people stuff. I always look forward to that, but it's all the behind the scenes, you know, from your podcast or your summit, there's all the behind the scenes stuff that people don't see. So there are still days like that, but it's all worth it when I sit down next to a mentee, or I host a retreat for 10 entrepreneurs, or I get to speak like this to you, you know. That's the Soul on Fire piece.
So do you think your Soul on Fire piece, then, what helped you sort of decide, yeah, this is what sets my soul on fire, is I would do this for free and it just absolutely lights me up and I don't think, oh, I don't want to go to work today. So it was really just almost getting in tune with what lights you up and what doesn't, because a lot of people, I think, and I'll include myself in this boat, have gone through phases where it's quite hard to differentiate when you're in the thick of it.
It's such a good question. I think there's that, yes, tick, 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 tick to everything you've just said. But for me, it's also the activities that I find flow in, that I'm not clock watching. I'm not thinking about what are we having for dinner. I'm there, and I'm there mind, body, soul. Like, that to me is the soul on fire. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally it does. And I can...
Like full presence.
Yeah, I can relate to that a lot. I've a few times recently, like, I've been doing a lot more speaking recently, and I'm like, God, if I can do this every day, like, I just, yep, I'll do this all day, every day. I love it.
Yeah,
that's awesome. So I want to now dig into, and this is where I'm super excited about, I was flicking last night at the first book. So we're going back to Remarkability.
Remarkability was the first book baby.
Had a moment. And you talk so much in it about getting shit done. And that's like, if anyone said to me, what are you really like, what do you think of Lorraine for? That would be how I would describe you, is like the queen of get shit done.
Yeah.
That's the box that I put you in. So I want to sort of bring in this back to business, go, what do you think, you know, you're now into your second business, which has also been, you know, raging success. You coach and mentor people every day on this. What do you think some of the keys are in business to breaking the barriers of execution and just truly getting shit done?
Such a good question. And we share a business manager, Michelle.
Yes.
And she describes me, how she puts it is like, your output is very high. In terms of like, when I put my mind to something, she's like, whoa. And she's used to working with me now, but I know when AJ came on board, who's my assistant, and AJ came on and AJ was like, well, Lorraine, how are you going to get, we were like launching, I think maybe we were launching Step Into You, which was my program last year, which is, I'm running again at the moment. So anyway, so AJ was like, how are you going to get all this done? And Michelle just looked at her and went, her output is very high. And AJ was like, okay. So I think for me, it's funny, I have been asked this question before. If I was to break it down, why I seem to get more shit done than some people might otherwise do, I think the first thing is I don't mess around with the stuff that's not actually going to move it forward. So it's really focusing on what are the activities that are going to move this forward. The second thing I think I do is I'm prepared to ship something before it's perfect. And to the extent that, I mean, it's only happened once, thankfully, but I did a program actually with my husband, Wade. We did a program called Couple Goals, which is all about helping couples do their goal setting, last year. And on that, there was a piece, we'd mentioned something in one of the videos, and that actually worksheet hadn't been included in the playbook that people got as part of the program. And someone said, hey, this is missing. And I was like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. Like, it's sorted. It's with the designer. We'll have it out to you within the next week. So I think it's being okay with that happening sometimes. Obviously, you don't want that to be happening every single time. But I think I'm happy to put stuff out there because I accept as an entrepreneur that nothing's ever going to be perfect. And pretty much as soon as we ship something as an entrepreneur, and when I mean ship as in like it's out there, it's birthed it into the world, we want to change it straight away. So that was very freeing for me when I realized that things don't have to be absolutely perfect, that I can just ship something and then tweak it as I go if I need to. So that's a huge one for me. And I think the other thing as well is playing to my strengths. Like, I would be the world's worst online business manager, whereas AJ on my team is exceptional at CRMs and setting up emails and doing all the tagging of this person was on the webinar, but they didn't go to this event. Oh my God. Like, it just makes me sick even thinking about it. So I think creating and one of my beautiful mentees, Christy, puts this so well, being in your zone of genius. And so doing the stuff that I'm really, really good at, because I can do that stuff in my sleep. Whereas Michelle or AJ can't write the emails, or they can't plan the programs or present a video, you know? So I think that's another really big one. What else would I say? How do I get shit done? And just proper planning. You know, this comes back to everything in my second book, Get Remarkably Organized. It's just having your shit together day to day. And thankfully, that's a realization I had in the very early days of my first business, that if I didn't have my shit together, this business wasn't going anywhere. It was actually probably going to go backwards. Because, and I know a lot of your audience won't be entrepreneurs as well, but for all of us, whether we've got our own businesses or not, we're wearing so many hats day to day, whether that's our personal lives hat or our leader hat or our strategist hat or whatever we might be wearing at work as well. And I think we need to plan our weeks and our lives in a way that's going to set us up for success and not be in reactive mode, which is something I believe, you know, you've probably sick of me talking about this, but the whole idea of looking after our future selves, it's absolutely critical and something I train teams on now, because if you're not looking after your future self, you're pretty much running faster and faster, but getting nowhere fast.
I love that. And that's actually on my, I had a hit list that I wanted to sort of, a few things I wanted to tap on.
Yeah.
And that was one of them. So for me, some of the stuff in the books I found really hard because I'm not as organized and I found not as natural. That's a better way of putting it. I found it not as natural to implement, but the one that I've
just organic.
The one that I've gone, that really works for me. And it's kind of funny because it's almost like, so it's Monday today when we're recording. Last night was Sunday. I really like on a Sunday night to just get organized for the week. So the week's not going to be quite as much of a shitstorm if we've just got our shit together. So it's interesting because even my husband's sarcastically going, I'm looking after my future self.
And we're bless like, him. You know, there's so many people have said that to me, that their partners use it or their kids as well. It's gold. And it's so simple.
I think he's saying it back to me in full sarcasm. But what's brilliant is this is one of the things that I've adopted from your books I found really easy to implement and has been more natural and actually really, really powerful and effective, because I've found, and I actually, I'll share this with you. I think I mentioned this to you in an email to you before the summit that we just had a couple of weeks ago. I, the weekend before, went, okay, how do I look after future Abby? How do I look after my future self? And I just got super organized, and I'm not disorganized, but I'm not super organized. I'm kind of somewhere in the middle. But I started packing my overnight bag, which is like unheard of a week before. I started getting everything together for the summit. And right at the last second, right before the summit, a lot of shit went down. And what was really interesting is I credit the fact that I stayed calm, I stayed cool, I stayed together. I didn't get flustered too. The Lorraine Murphy strategy of look after your future self. And I actually talked about it. I think I talked about it to Michelle as well. And sort of said that process served me so well, because at the last minute when everything was going wrong, I didn't lose my mind because so much had already been looked after and organized. So talk to us a bit more about that one around looking after your future self.
And you know, this is the thing, Abby, and you've just articulated so perfectly, because I think we often get caught up in, like, if we're organized or we're looking after our future selves, it's boring. You know, it's It's like, oh my God, life loses all spontaneity and dynamism. But what we actually do is when we can look after our future selves as much as possible, it just means that we're as much as possible controlling what we can control. And then when things spin out of control, like before your event, you had whatever happened, it just means that you've got more capacity to deal with it. Because I talk a lot about the idea that as human beings, we need a balance of certainty and uncertainty. So when you've got a lot of uncertainty, like the first time you were doing your summit, for example, or maybe it's someone's first time presenting to a team or whatever's happening, when you've got that level of uncertainty, you actually need to, in order to feel settled and centered in yourself, you need to balance that with certainty. So for me, the looking after your future self thing is definitely about being more organized, but it's also about creating certainty in times of a lot of uncertainty. So for me, I know when I started my first business, or even now, like for me, my thing is a big cook up at the weekend. So I know that there's food in the fridge. So it sounds so trite, but just knowing that there's food organized and there's that amount of certainty makes a huge difference to how my week goes. So for you, getting, you know, having your overnight bag packed, and that just creates certainty in times of uncertainty, because you don't know how this summit's going to go. You don't know if a speaker's going to pull it. I'm not saying that's what happened. I don't know what happened. Or you don't know the venue's going to cancel it. You just don't know. But if we know that we've looked after our future selves as much as possible, it just means that when things do and life just happens, you know, you and I both know that, it just means that we're more equipped to deal with it. And we can just roll with the punches a bit more, for, you know, want of a less violent example. So the whole idea of looking after your future self is just, it's the micro things. It's like bringing your clothes that you've just folded from the laundry upstairs now, rather than bringing them up right before you have to go to bed. It's, in a business sense, then it's having the difficult conversation with a colleague today and not having it weighing on your mind till tomorrow or the next day. It's doing things like doing the washing up at night so that you come down in the morning and your future self is so happy because your past self looked after your future self so well. So it's a really, really simple concept. But when I'm training, so I do a lot of training with corporates and organizations. So when I'm training them, I say, like, this future self concept, it can be as micro as you want it to be, or it can be as macro as you want it to be. So if, for example, we're in a relationship that we know isn't going very well, like it's looking after a future self to wrap that relationship up sooner rather later, because then our future self, when they've met the man or woman of their dreams, is like, yes, I'm so glad I did this, because now I'm free to meet this person. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And for me, sometimes it's the basic thing. So like, actually last night was a great example. So last night I got Jaylen's daycare bag ready to go. I knew I was doing this podcast with you, so I printed out some of my notes and my questions I'd been thinking through. So this morning when I woke up with, and Lorraine, poor thing, has had to see the shocking image of an eye after being bitten and my eye won't open.
God, you poor thing.
And this morning going to Havoc, I was actually super organized because actually yes. Everything else had been done, so I could deal with that situation and not be going, because I'd actually got organized on. So it's not necessarily for me always the big things. It's some of the little things, like printing out my notes ready to go for the podcast with Lorraine.
Yeah. And, you know, I think it's the little things that have the greater impact, the small things. So, yeah, it's amazing how when you just start to think about it and be conscious of it, all the little ways that you can find to look after your future self.
I agree. And it's actually a standout for me. When I was flicking back through the books, I was like, that is a real standout in terms of things that have impacted my life. And like last week or awesome. Week before for Summit, I was like, yep, that one massively made a difference. So yeah. I want to go back, because you were talking before about being okay with putting out, you used your example of your program with Wade, where actually, whoops, you know, something got missed, and it, you know, not waiting for it to be 100% perfect, and being okay with sometimes it's about taking massive imperfect action. Because if we're looking and talking about barriers to execution, waiting for things to be perfect is a massive one. So for anyone who just had heart palpitations when you talked about not waiting for things to be perfect, how do you coach and advise your mentees around this if someone is feeling that perfectionist tendency?
Well, I think, you know, there's two cases, right? There's putting stuff out that's substandard, which is not okay. But then there's also putting something out that, you know, that if you spent, how can I articulate this? I learned this, I think it was at a workshop before I was taught this. The whole idea of, like, the first, let's just say, right, the first 10 hours that you put into a project are going to be the most powerful, because that's when you actually get it moving, right? Then you put another 10 hours into it, which fine tunes it and gets it really good. you put another 10 hours in, and that's where it's like, okay, you could ship this as it is now. Like it's workable, you know, it's what am I saying? It's like your minimal viable product. Yeah. It's there. It's at your MVP. And then you put another 10 hours in and you're like, okay, cool. This is actually really good. This would be good. So I can't remember who was training me on this. The whole thing is that once you get to that point, that tipping point, the more time that you spend on it, it's going to have less and less impact on the quality of the end product. So you might spend another 10 hours and another 10 hours, and another 10 hours, but it might only move the dial by 0.5% at that point. So it's about deciding what's the sweet spot for you, that you know that you've put X amount of time into this, that it's quality, like it's good. And then you decide then, okay, well, if I spend another 2 days on this, it's really not going to change the end product that much. So I should probably just ship it. But I don't think that people hold back from shipping things. And I get the phrase shipping from Stephen Pressfield. It's a brilliant book called Do the Work. And his second book is actually on my reading list for this year, which is The War of Art. So he talks about shipping. But I don't think people hold off on shipping something because they don't think it's good. I think they hold off because they're afraid of failing. So when you actually finally put it out into the world, that's when people could say it's shit. And that's your worst nightmare, particularly if you're doing something creative or something someone hasn't done before, you haven't done before. So I think it's getting over that. I think it's getting over that fear of failure, I think, is the challenge.
So how do you coach then either yourself or mentees around getting over the fear of failure? If that's what's preventing us from executing, how do we overcome that part?
What I'll often talk to people about is, and I feel like this is a muscle that I've flexed so much that I don't really have it. Like I can ship something quite quickly, and like if it bombs, does that make sense? And it doesn't affect me as much. So I think it's almost like a comfort zone. Like the more we practice getting something out there, the broader I think our comfort zone becomes. But to answer your question, I think the big thing I will ask if someone's really, really like freaking out about shipping something, I will often say, look, what's the worst that could happen? And get them to go there, because often we don't want to go to the worst case scenario. But when we do go to the worst case scenario, and maybe the worst case scenario is like no one buys it and it's shit, well then, what's the outcome? Okay, well, you've spent X amount of money on creating this thing. It hasn't worked. And so then that's kind of it. You know, there's nothing attached to that. So I think telling the story without the story, I think, is very powerful. And what I mean by telling without story, it's saying, well, I put this new thing, and, you know, I'll be very frank with you, you a couple of goals didn't go as well as we'd hoped it would. For various different reasons, I think we got the price point was too high. I think secondly, launching something over Christmas, I wouldn't do again because it just breaks the flow too much of your, when I launched Step Into You, for example, it was 3 weeks of really concentrated communication. And then the cart opened and everyone moved on. Whereas I think launching something over Christmas, we had it open for 5 or 6 weeks, which is just too long. So, I've taken myself at a tangent. So yes, I guess what I'm saying is, even though I'm saying I don't worry about shipping stuff as much as I used to, it doesn't mean that everything I do is a perfect success. So I think it's going to the worst case and saying, okay, well, no one, and happily a lot of people did buy a couple of goals. It just wasn't as big as we thought it would be. It's saying, well, telling the story without the story. So with couple goals, I'm not saying, oh, it was a crap course. Myself and Wade should never do anything again together. It was just the timing, I think, and the price point. So it's not taking it on as an emotional burden myself. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think it's also about getting real life feedback as well. And like, rather than waiting, so you and I were talking about before recording, and I really need to learn the lesson to press record straight away that Julie told me about, but it was a really good conversation.
Oh, just in case there's little grabs.
Yeah, it was so good. Because you were asking me how's the Execution Zone membership going, and I was saying to you, yeah, oh, really good, but there's been a couple surprises of like people who have signed up. I wouldn't have expected them to sign up straight away, and you know, some of the people I thought would sign up straight away haven't, and like it was some of the real world market feedback has actually been really, really valuable. And so I think what you're talking about as well is really important, because getting a minimum viable product, it's almost like the lean startup methodology, and then testing it in the real world, you can then go, well, actually, hey, is my price point slightly out, or hey, am I appealing more to these people than I thought, and then adapt on the fly and go, rather than having, you know, 5, 6, however many months in your head making those assumptions which haven't been validated.
Yeah, makes total sense. Yeah,
So how do you, I want to tap into, before you're just talking there about, you know, you might have a setback, but you don't take it personally. Is that something that you've trained yourself on because you've now been doing this for quite a while, you know, or is it something that naturally you've just always been quite good at bouncing back from a perceived setback?
It's such a good question. You know, it's an interesting one because in my first business, if something didn't work out, it wasn't necessary. I mean, it was me because I own the business. But it wasn't necessarily on me. And I've actually found it a very, because I think when I was thinking about selling the Remarkables Group and just going out and doing the Lorraine show, which is pretty much what I'm doing now, I just thought there was so much freedom and autonomy and it'd be so great and easy and all that kind of thing. But what I didn't bargain on was the sense of, because it's me, that if an event doesn't sell out or if I don't get the listens on a podcast episode or if the program doesn't sell as well as I thought it would, that I underestimated how difficult that is when it's you that people don't want to buy. And I know that it's not me, and it's just the package. It's whatever I've packaged up of myself, because it's a bit of me, as everything anyone ever creates is. I found that really, really difficult to deal with. And particularly early last year, I did an event back in Ireland because I was going back to Ireland, and I said, you know, I'd love to do an event, like go home a success story and all the crap that I told myself. And it was actually really, really hard to fill that event. I moved down to a smaller venue and I filled it. There was 8 people in the room, which felt really good, but it wasn't the 40 people that I thought I would get. And I remember actually I went to New York with my husband. We did a little kind of sneaky mama daddy getaway. And we were walking across the Brooklyn Bridge and I was in tears about this event because I said, you know, people don't want me. Like, it's not that I'm hosting this big event for bloggers or we're launching a new, I don't know, whatever we're doing in my previous business, it's me. So I did find that very difficult to deal with and to a certain extent still do. However, what I've found is that it's important to keep moving forward and keep putting out new things because you just don't know what people are going to jump on. So I did my Step Into You program last year, which is the first time I've done that program, and it just went gangbusters. Like, I set a target of getting double the amount of people, double what I had only ever gotten. So the most people that I'd ever gotten in a previous program, I doubled that. That was my target. And I just was like, this is happening. Because honestly, when I went into that program, I'd had a few knocks. Like, there was a few things that just hadn't worked out. So what I wanted to do was to do Step Into You, smash it out of the park. And I did that. And it was amazing just having that success really buffered me, is that the right word? Bolstered me. It was a real morale boost, which then gave me the confidence to go and try something new again, which was Couple Goals, which wasn't as amazing as Step Into You. Love working on it and love the feedback. But yeah, I think it's important just to keep going, because I think often we get a bit of a knock and it affects our self-confidence and then we just stop. And that's actually the worst thing to do, because if I had stopped around that time, that Irish event, I would never have done Step Into You and got to help so many women as part of that program. And I just loved every minute of that program. It just had the most beautiful flow to it.
So it's more about keep going, get back on the horse. Don't just go, right, that's it, I'm giving up and throwing the towel. And actually building the resilience by just going again. And, you know, some things are going to be winners, some things aren't going to be as strong, but it's just dust yourself off, get back up and go again, and don't hold it. Don't let that event hold you back from going on to the next one.
Exactly. And don't let that event hold you back from future success. You know, don't let it get in the way, you know?
Yeah, I totally agree. And I love that. And I think you're very good at that. Like, you can see that because you're very open in your emails about things that have worked really well, things that haven't worked well. So Lorraine does, Lorraine does weekly love letters, which are awesome. And subscribe via Lorraine's website. But it's what I like about it is you're also very honest at going, I did X, it didn't work, or this has been really difficult because of Y. And so you're very good at actually sharing. It's not all just roses and sunshine.
Yeah.
It's also some of the crappy stuff that you have to go through to get to the good stuff.
Yeah. And I think that's such an important conversation for people to be having, because when I had the Remarkables Group, and my husband Wade would say this, he's like, you had no idea. There was such a strong tailwind to that business in terms of influencer marketing was coming, whether I was there or not. I started a great business with a great name and it just worked. Like, it worked so well after, you know, and like, not without lots of bumps and how am I going to pay the team next week and all that crap that is part and parcel of business. But what I really, I didn't realize that actually I feel like this second business has been more of a of real life. And so I think it's, sorry, I've totally lost my train of thought with that. It's been a bigger learning exercise this time. And what I've realized is that so much of the media that I got in my first business was like all the achievements, the excitement, the yay. And I really made a commitment, particularly because this business hasn't been as easy a journey as the first one. I just wanted to be really honest about it because it sucks when you're having a hard time in your business or your career or just your life. And all you're reading about is someone else's highlights. It's not real life. So that's something that I really have made a commitment to speaking very, very honestly about. And what I've realized, because I think I used to think, oh, if I talk about my failures or my misses, that people won't respect me or connect with me as much. And actually, people connect more with me when I talk about I wouldn't have anywhere near as many requests for mentoring with me if I just talked about how great my life was. It's that I've been through things, I've built the resilience, and I've known how to get out of them. That's what people are attracted to in other people.
I agree with that entirely, because I think it's I think otherwise you sort of feel like, what the hell am I doing wrong? Because, you know, everyone else just opens up their business doors and, you know, just, you know.
And it's all rosy.
It's all rosy and it just goes gangbusters. And I think that it's people, you know, like myself, I speak for myself, you know, you find people like yourself relatable in that context when you're talking about the shit days, because then you feel normal because you're like, oh, cool, they have shit days too.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
So you just talked there about...
And you know, sorry, can I just touch on that?
Yeah, please do.
Because I've just had like an aha moment as you're talking. It also takes the pressure off me to be perfect.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
Like I'm not going around every day going, oh, I need to run this perfect business. It just takes all that pressure away.
Yes,
so 100%. I think that's the other thing as well, is if we're not trying to craft this perfect image with people, like we're not just making it easier for them and making ourselves more relatable. We're actually taking so much pressure off ourselves to be this magical glittery unicorn every single day, which is completely impossible.
And that you can't, no one can keep up.
yeah, exactly.
I want to touch on there. You talked there about almost a comparison point between the first business and the second business, which I think is really interesting. What else do you think have been some of your learnings sort of second time around that you go, oh, now that I've, you know, got a couple more years under my belt, I do X, Y, Z differently. And, you know, some of those lessons that then in turn you can impart with people that you coach.
Yeah, such a good question. Because these businesses are so different. And something I was chatting with one of my friends, Jack DeLose, I interviewed him for my podcast recently. And we were talking about in the podcast and I was saying, you know, I underestimated how different this business is going to be because the type of sales, you know, the type of sales that I was used to doing was corporate. Like I would go in, I would put together a knockout presentation for Woolworths or Qantas or Bonds or Priceline. They would love it. You know, this is all like on the days it went really well. And they would sign and off we went. Whereas this business is so different because it's digital sales. You know, it's building, it's content driven. Like it's so different. So I guess the lessons that I would learn between, So a big one, I think, is being very conscientious about the energy of the people I surround myself with. So if I look back to my first business, there were a lot of people that I tolerated. Tolerated seems rude, but our energies wasn't compatible. And there's some people that I could definitely look back and think they were very forceful, whose energy overrode my energy. Do you ever have that feeling where you're with someone and you just don't feel as powerful because it's almost like they zap your energy for whatever reason?
I call it energy vampires.
Yeah, it's that, but it's not. I know the energy vampires, but I totally hear you on that. It's them, but it's also just the people who just created more drama than necessary. And I fed that drama. So maybe it is energy vampires. So I think something I've been very conscious of in this business is having those people who are 100% in the team with me. And they were never employees that I'm talking about. It was more like clients or kind of people as like the next layer out of the kind of the inner circle of the business. So I think that's a big one. I mean, holy God, if I worked as efficiently as I do now in my first business, I would have made it a $10 million a year business, hands down. Because also I think it's coupled with the fact that I'm now a mother and there's a certain amount of energy that I need to hold in reserve in order to be a mother and do what I want to do on that side of things. So I think, working efficiently, shit, Abby, I could probably do a whole podcast interview on this one.
Hey, this could be your next book. We might.
I know. I'm actually
just come up with your next book.
Moment. I think they're the biggest ones. I think it's the working efficiently and also the being very, very, very intentional and conscientious about the energy that I have around me as well. That would be the two biggest ones, I think.
Yeah, I love that.
And, you know, also to remember as well, there's a lot of stuff that I did in my first business that I continue to do in my second business. So not getting bogged down in stuff that I'm not good at or I don't enjoy and giving that to other people to do. I mean, I still do that. The thing that we started talking about in the early in this conversation about making people feel like rock stars, because they are, you know, making people feel special and making that just almost part of the fabric of my business. I think that's something that I continue to do, hopefully to some success. And yeah, just trying new things, not being afraid to try new things. I think I've also continued to do that in the second business as well.
I also, just touching on your rock star point, what I also love about that at the moment as, you know, you do it very naturally and organically. So me saying it's a strategy set makes it sound like it's something it's not. But where I'm going with this is I think it's also quite hard to copy and replicate because that's your brand and that's just organically and naturally you. So you can talk about, you know, what other coaches or mentors are there, what other programs are there, but that sort of factor is just so you that it makes you hard to copy and stand out, if that makes
sense.
Yeah,
that makes sense. Yeah, it makes total sense. Yeah. And it's personal brand. You know, Julie would have probably spoken to this beautifully at your summit and influence. It's, I think we think about when we're thinking of building a personal brand or a brand of any sort is that it needs to be this carefully crafted, manufactured entity, whereas actually it's just you amplified. Like that's how I talk about it with my mentees, is that don't worry about you crafting this perfect personal brand. It's just you and amplifying you. Yeah. So that's something I do. I mean, I've sent handwritten thank you cards for Jesus. I got into that when I was, I mean, almost like my entire career I've done that. So that's nothing new. I mean, that's what, I've got to think about it, 15 years that I've been doing that. So that's just me, you know?
Yeah,
but it's absolutely. Not to say that if someone hasn't sent thank you cards before, it's not a really good thing to do now. You can always start.
I love that. That's one thing that I actually have really doubled down on in the business and done. And I think reading, I got that one from, again, something I've always done. Like my parents were very much into send thank you cards, like after Christmas
so
or
special.
Birthday presents. And like I do that for Jaden's birthday and stuff and send everyone thank
you
cards.
Lovely.
They're probably seriously bloody late, but they get there eventually.
So you're good. That's something I need to improve on, Lexi's social secretarying. That's a really lovely thing you do that.
Oh, no, let's be honest about it. I just sent 2019 Christmas thank you cards with the 2018 photo. So they got them a year late, but they did get them.
They got it.
But I think that reading that point in your book made me enhance that and double down on it and go, actually, that's a really nice touch. I need to proactively do more of it. So I think that's sort of something that I also took away from your books. So look, I'm conscious that I'm grabbing lots and lots of your time and I've got several things that I still want to touch on. So if it's okay, I want to do a bit of a quick fire round with you.
Yep, let's do it.
So I would consider you someone who absolutely plays a high performance game. And what I find interesting is when I read your books, you know, you're very much into mindset, you're into healthy eating, you're into exercise, you're very much into getting yourself organized, you know, all these different things, plus you're a mum, plus you're a business owner. So if you are having an extraordinarily busy week, more so than usual, out of all of those different things that you subscribe to and practice what you preach on, what would be your one or two non-negotiables that you would put above everything else?
That's a great question. I'd probably approach that from two directions. I think one is that beautiful, happy, present time with Lexi. I find she's very stress relieving when she's not going completely crazy. But I think just even if it's 10 minutes just to sit on the floor and play with her, she's got like a Peppa Pig and her spirit horse stuff. You know, just those 10 minutes, I find that really beautiful. Because also just I had a lengthy conversation with my husband about this over lunch today. It's the point of it all. You know, we get so caught up in these businesses and the stress and the cash flow and the iteration and blah. Really, when it boils down to it, it's us, you know, it's our family. That's the point of it all. So that's been a bit of a like ping moment for me over the last week or so. So I think that's really, really special. And it forces me to remember that actually I don't have to be rushing all the time. Like I can just have 10 minutes with her and make it fun and be present with her. I think the other side then would be the health side of things, like trying to max out sleep. I mean, coffee is not good for me. I just go absolutely psycho. Not psycho, but I get very jittery and it makes me anxious. So if I am heading into a very, very full on week, it's about being more mindful about what I'm putting into myself, because that's going to affect how I'm feeling. So if I'm sugared, if I'm caffeined, that's not good. And then, yeah, as much as possible, sleep. I mean, unfortunately, it seems, I don't know if you've experienced this, but sometimes when you've got the most full weeks, they're the most that's when your child decides that they don't want to sleep, or
100%, you're burning
the candle at both ends. You know, I was speaking at an event in Wagga a couple of weeks ago, and like it finished at 10 p.m. and I was on a flight at 6:30 the next morning to Sydney, and then flew straight up to Byron Bay and ran a retreat for 4 days. So there's going to be weeks like that where you can't control your sleep, but as much as possible, trying to, because yeah, life's just easier when you've got sleep. I know you'll subscribe to that, given your tales of woe with Jaden's sleep for the first while. So yeah, does that answer your question?
Yeah, absolutely it does. It really, really does. And it
goes without saying, the future self shit on steroids, like any way possible, looking after my future self, simplifying, streamlining, getting as much done on, you know, the week before as possible, just like you did with your summit, all that.
Yeah, I agree with that one. And that's something I definitely subscribe to. My next one is, so we've talked a lot here about, okay, you might start a new habit around looking after your future self. You might start a new habit around healthier eating or getting really organized, whatever it might be. What's one or two quick tips that you would give people to kickstart that habit? Because it's all well and good us saying it, but it's not always as easy as that to actually start.
That's a great question. I think the first one is to, first of all, decide, make whatever the habit it is that you want to practice, make it achievable. Because I think the biggest mistake a lot of us make when it comes to putting in new habits is they're too stretched. They're almost like stretch goals every single day. So the first thing I would say is to make it achievable. And you know, something that you could pretty easily, like, for example, I've been meaning to start to meditate for flipping years. And then finally just was sitting on the sofa for 5 minutes. Then it went up to 10 minutes, then 15. And now I would happily meditate for 20 minutes and I would love it. So, well, sometimes it's just an absolute struggle, but that's the whole point of it, I guess. So I would say, first of all, make it achievable, make it accessible, whatever it is you're choosing to do. And the second thing I love, I've got like a little weekly habit scorecard. So if I am trying to bed something in, stick it up in the fridge and like tick it every day that I do it. It's amazing how many times I've gotten out of bed a bit early to do my meditation, but I know I'm going to wait to tick the piece of paper on the fridge at the end of the day. So they'd be my two biggest ones. But then also, I think what really separates the kind of the survivors out from the thrivers day to day is the survivors, if there's any knock to their schedule, like for me, for example, I've been traveling a lot for business for the last 4 weeks. Today, as we're recording this, I've got my beautiful aunt and uncle have just arrived from Ireland, so I'll be seeing them in a couple of hours. But I think for the people who don't seem to get as much shit done, I think it's those disruptions, they allow them to take them off course. So whereas if someone who's, you know, quite proactive is looking after their future self, they will practice the habit. If something happens, like they get sick or a colleague sick and they have to cover their role for a week or two, whatever's happening, it's just about getting back in the driving seat quickly. So I think that's what separates the wheat from the chaff, if that makes sense. It's the not allowing the disruptions to completely disrupt and instead just having them as, yeah, they're obstacles that we can overcome and get back on track pretty quickly.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, a hell of a lot of sense. So my final question for you, you've mentioned a few books along the way and I've been scribbling them down as someone who's just absolutely a book junkie. Some of them I've read, some of them I haven't. What would be your top recommendation on must read books that have been had the biggest impact on you?
Oh God. Are we talking about like any genre, or are we talking specifically to execution or sales or business?
I'll let you have any genre for something that would appeal to, so our audience being either a business owner or a leader.
I would say for that one, Mastering the Rockefeller Habits by Vern Harnish. It's a book I read in the first year of my business, and I was really anxious about running a business, particularly when I'd hired a couple of staff, because I just had no infrastructure. I didn't see myself as a leader. I've never run a business before. I just didn't actually know where to start. So I think for me, Mastering the Rockefeller Habits gave me an infrastructure on which to base myself. And then from there, my leadership style, my entrepreneurial style, my business development style grew from there. So it basically talks about, we need a 5-year vision, we need a 1-year vision, and we need a 90-day plan. And that's all we need to worry about. And to this day, I mean, I read that book 7 years ago, and that's still how I run my business, my 90-day plans. Michelle will tell you, kind of within the first week of the new quarter, I'm sitting there with the team going through my plan, getting them across it. And it's all about, what do we need to tick off over the next 3 months? And I find that rhythm really, really effective.
Ironically, I have one of your 90-day plans, like templates.
Oh, have you?
Insight. So I literally have stuck up around me like different, you know, vision boards or different scoreboards that I'm following. And I have one of your 90-day planners in my line of sight at the moment. So I was kind of chuckling to myself as you said that.
Oh, yeah. It's just something about 90 days because it's enough time to pick off something really big and get it done. But it's not so much time that you leave it on the back burner. Like if it's a new website, for example, like you need to get started in month one in order to have that ready by month three. So yeah, I find that really, really, really effective.
Amazing. Lorraine, you have been absolutely incredible. You have shared so many gems and so openly and honestly. Where can people go to find out more about yourself and to follow you? I'll put some notes in the show notes, but it'd be good to get the top places of where you hang out.
Well, it's pretty limited. Instagram, so at Lorraine Remarks is my Insta handle, and also my website, lorrainemurphy.com.au, and also my podcast, so very, very unimaginatively titled The Lorraine Murphy Show, and I have a new episode go live every Friday. So that, yeah, I get a lot of very, very positive feedback on the podcast. I think that's a really good place to go as well. So yeah,
podcast,
Instagram, website.
I love
and obviously
podcast.
Sign up for my emails on the website as well. So I send a Monday Mentor every Monday, and then every second Thursday I send the love letter.
Yeah, I like the love letter ones. They're my favorites.
Yeah, people. Oh, I didn't send them. I got Bali Belly when I was in Bali a few weeks ago. And I had the choice. I was like, either I'm going to do my podcast episode or I'm going to write my love letter. And I did the podcast episode. And I think about 10 people emailed AJ going, did I miss the love letter? I was like, oh my God. I said to her, I was like, I didn't think people would even notice. And she's like, no, people like your love letter a lot. And I think it's just, I mean, that's it. It's a love letter. It's very intimate. And I think it reads very differently to a lot of kind of the newsletter type stuff that goes out. So,
yeah, I would.
It's just for me, it's just like writing to a friend.
I would absolutely second that and agree. Lorraine, thank you so much.
I really
appreciate your time. Thank you for listening to this episode. If you would like to join the Execution Zone as a guest and experience one of our workshops, please visit our website, theexecutionzone.com, and find out more there. Before you leave us, don't forget to subscribe. And if you love this episode, please leave a review and share it with your friends.